The money. And that's what you're saying is happening, that somebody is bribing state legislators?
Yeah, but that's not all. They're bribing judges, too. If a law gets passed they don't like, they'll file a lawsuit, and then if they need to, they'll bribe judges to overturn the law.
Who's this they you're talking about?
There are a lot of theys, Sarah said. I mean, there are a lot of individuals and political organizations and corporations who are manipulating state legislators and judges, but the guy I'm after is Leonard Curtis.
I've never heard of him, DeMarco said, and Sarah's expression said,
And why am I not surprised by this? Curtis is an independent natural gas driller, she said.
But what makes you think
the biggest thing happening in this country, energy-wise, is natural gas, and North Dakota has been called Kuwait on the Prairie. South Dakota and Montana also have gas and oil reserves, and huge corporations like Exxon and Conoco and big independents like Devon and Anadarko are all going after the gas. It's like the California gold rush out here. Workers are living in shanty towns and trailers and RVs, and so many people are coming here that housing prices have skyrocketed, and it's hard to get a motel room. They just can't develop the infrastructure fast enough to support all the drilling. At the same time, there are all kinds of issues, environmental issues, property issues, tax issues, related to natural gas. I mean, you've heard of fracking, haven't you?
Sure, DeMarco said. That's when they pump in water to get the gas out.
Not just water, but chemicals. And fracking can contaminate groundwater and cause earthquakes.
Earthquakes? Is there any scientific evidence that fracking...
My point, Sarah said impatiently, is that there are all sorts of legal issues related to natural gas, which means laws are getting passed to regulate the industry, and sometimes the laws are good for the gas companies and sometimes they're not. And what Leonard Curtis is doing in every way he can is making sure the laws are favorable to him.
Aren't other companies doing the same thing?
Yeah, probably, almost certainly. But I know Curtis is doing things that are illegal, and I can't take on an entire industry. I figured if I'd focused on one guy, I'd have a better chance of making a case. And Curtis is into everything. Drilling, land leases, pipelines, drilling equipment, anything to do with natural gas.
And you think he's bribing people?
Quit saying that. Quit saying I think. I know he is.
How many people are in these state legislatures? DeMarco asked.
In Montana, there are 100 in the House and 50 in the Senate. North Dakota is about the same as Montana. In South Dakota, there are 70 in the House and 35 in the Senate.
And Curtis is bribing all of them?
Of course not. Don't be stupid. First of all, the state houses in all three states are currently controlled by the Republicans. And a lot of Republicans support drilling because they want the United States to be energy independent and because the industry creates jobs. Right now, North Dakota has the lowest unemployment rate in the nation thanks to natural gas. So the state houses are tilted in Curtis's favor, and he doesn't have to do much to get a lot of these folks to vote the way he wants. He contributes to their campaigns, and these are little local campaigns where a few $1,000 goes a long way. But these Republicans aren't a bunch of sheep, and a lot of them are farmers and ranchers, and they care about the environment and anything that affects their property and mineral rights. And Curtis doesn't always need to get a law passed. Sometimes all he needs to do is slow things down, so legislation gets delayed. Or if there's a politician who's ranting against something Curtis wants, he just needs to quiet the politician down.
Sarah, have you actually got any evidence that Curtis has bribed anyone? I mean, have you witnessed him bribing somebody, or has anyone been willing to go on record that Curtis bought them off?
No.
Then how do you know?
Let me give you an example. You know what a blowout preventer is? The device that failed in the Deepwater Horizon and dumped 5 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, DeMarco said.
There was a bill going through the North Dakota State House to increase inspection requirements for blowout preventers. And naturally, Curtis was against the bill because more inspections would delay production and increase his costs. This one Republican named Stevens sided with the Democrats on the bill, and he was pushing his party to approve it. Stevens is actually a pretty good guy when it comes to balancing energy production against environmental concerns. Well, Stevens is a farmer, and to get to his farm, he uses a road that passes through another farm. Stevens has an easement from the other farmer, allowing him to use the road, and his dad had it before him. But one day, the other farmer says he's not going to allow Stevens to use the road anymore, and this meant that Stevens would have to drive an extra 20 miles to get to his place. To make matters worse, the road he'd be required to use has a bridge that goes over a little creek, and it's not rated for heavy loads. Stevens filed a lawsuit, of course, but the lawsuit was going to drag on for a year, and in the meantime, Stevens would go broke. The next thing that happens, don't you know, Stevens stops supporting the bill. It fails in the Senate, and he gets the easement back. You see?
DeMarco shook his head. And that's it? A guy won't let him use a road, and then the guy changes his mind, and Stevens changes his vote?
Yes. Nobody gave Stevens a bag full of cash. Curtis just created a situation where Stevens would go bankrupt if he didn't play ball.
How did you find all this stuff out about Stevens and the easement and the other farmer?
When Stevens changed his position, I wanted to know why, and I started digging. I talked to people, like the Democrats he'd been working with, and his lawsuit, of course, was a matter of public record.
But you don't know for sure that Curtis made the other farmer cancel the easement, or why he did it, or if that's the reason Stevens changed his vote.
I do know. I just can't prove it. Stevens denies it, of course. And when I asked the other farmer, who his neighbors all said is a shitty farmer and up to his neck in debt, he refused to talk to me. But I know.
Before DeMarco could object again, she held up a hand to silence him. There was another case. A Democrat who lives in Williston, which is right about in the middle of the Bakken oil field. She was making a big stink about flaring, and saying that Curtis was one of the biggest polluters.
Flaring? DeMarco said.
Jesus, Sarah muttered, appalled by DeMarco's ignorance. Flaring is where they vent off and burn waste gases that supposedly can't be efficiently captured and processed. If you were to go up in space, it would look like there are 10,000 bonfires burning on the Great Plains. They actually have satellite pictures showing this. Flaring is bad, in that it not only contributes to greenhouse gases, but it actually wastes a lot of gas. They're burning off millions of cubic feet of gas a day.
DeMarco wondered if she was exaggerated, but he doubted she was.
So why do the gas companies do it? He said.
Because it's cheaper to flare the gas than it is to install the equipment to capture it. Or they'll say it's for safety reasons. Anyway, this legislator from Williston runs a bakery, and she was pushing for legislation to reduce flaring. Then out of the blue comes an old lady who looks like everybody's grandma, and she files a lawsuit saying she was poisoned by a cupcake.
A cupcake?
Yeah. She said she found rat feces in the cupcake, and it made her sick, and she got a lawyer to file a suit. This baker couldn't afford to fight a lawsuit, and if a rumor got out that she had rat shit in her flour, it would kill her business. Then the same thing happened, just like with Stevens. The lawsuit was dropped and the baker quit being a squeaky wheel. When I asked her about it, she started crying and wouldn't talk to me. Shouldn't you be taking notes or something?
No, DeMarco said. I don't need to take notes, not at this point. I get the gist of what you're saying, but the thing is, I'm not sure what to do next. I have to give it some thought.
Well, I know what you need to do, Sarah said, her eyes blazing like they might set DeMarco's martini on fire. First, you need to go read my blog, and then get Mr. Mahoney to read it.
DeMarco almost laughed out loud. Mahoney never read anything. The people who worked for him read the documents that Mahoney was supposed to read, then told him what the documents said.
Then what Mahoney needs to do is convince the Attorney General to investigate Curtis. What Curtis is doing isn't happening in a single state, so it would be appropriate to get the FBI and the Justice Department involved. They need to form up a federal task force.
A federal task force? DeMarco said. Based on a cupcake lawsuit?
Shit, I'm just wasting my time with you, Sarah said.
She started to get up, but DeMarco placed a hand on her forearm. Hold on, Sarah. I just need to think about all this. Then maybe I'll talk to Mahoney. He had no intention of talking to Mahoney.
Okay,
Sarah said. Then tears welled up in her eyes.
I just can't get anybody to take me seriously, and this is serious stuff. Curtis is making a mockery out of democracy, and nobody cares.
I care, Sarah.
Actually, the only thing DeMarco really cared about was this girl not getting hurt. Although he admired her courage and her commitment, he thought she was being naive if she believed she could change a political system that had become blatantly corrupt. She also didn't seem to understand that without solid evidence, which she didn't appear to have, She would never be able to prove to the satisfaction of any court in the land that Curtis was doing anything illegal. But his job wasn't to help her advance her cause. His job, as far as he was concerned, was to keep her from getting killed.
"Now tell me," DeMarco said, "about these death threats and the other things people have done to try to get you to stop."
Chapter 6.
"Do you hear me?" Curtis said. "I want that bitch to quit writing about me."
Marjorie and Bill were still sitting in the Perot Grill with Leonard Curtis, less than 2 miles from where DeMarco was meeting with Sarah Johnson. By now their coffee was cold, and the waitress didn't bring them fresh cups because Curtis had rudely instructed the waitress to leave them alone. Sarah Johnson's blog was the bane of Curtis's existence. It was a disorganized, unstructured mess that, if printed out, would run 2,000 pages, and it served 3 purposes. First, Johnson used it as a journal, or a diary, in which she recounted what she'd done that day and her relentless pursuit of Leonard Curtis. It discussed, in mind-numbing detail, legislation or legal cases she'd researched. She also named people she'd talked to, usually castigating those people for incompetence or stupidity. Marjorie and Bill, therefore, pretty much always knew what Johnson was doing because she told the whole world. The second part of the blog was an ongoing rant against the American political system, and Johnson raved about how Curtis manipulated politicians with campaign contributions, took them on junkets, and paid for misleading television ads. She admitted that what Curtis was doing was arguably legal, but she wanted everyone to know how he was using his vast wealth solely to benefit Leonard Curtis, as opposed to the common people. It was the third part of the blog that was the real problem, however, and the reason for Curtis's angst. What Johnson would do was look for any legal or legislative issue in the tri-state area that affected Curtis. Next, she would identify people who appeared to be pivotal to the legislation passing or failing, or to a lawsuit being decided in Curtis's favor. Marjorie couldn't even imagine the hundreds of hours Johnson spent researching and investigating. Johnson's final step would then be to find some evidence, no matter how circumstantial or far-fetched, that a key person had been bribed, coerced, or otherwise unduly influenced. However, the evidence, if you could even call it evidence, could never be tied directly to anything Curtis had done personally. Nor had Johnson been able to find a single person willing to admit that he'd been bribed or coerced. But the problem was that Johnson was right. In the past 2 years, she had uncovered 11 instances where Curtis had in fact bribed or coerced politicians. Marjorie had tried dozens of times to convince Curtis that Sarah Johnson wasn't worth going after and that he should simply ignore her. She told Curtis that less than 50 people a week read Johnson's rambling blog. For that matter, they weren't sure that anybody actually read it. They could just see that less than 50 people a week visited her website, and 8 of those people were Bill, Marjorie, Leonard Curtis, and 5 lawyers. One reason so few people read her blog was that Johnson didn't have the ability to make the complex legal issues she wrote about simpler and more understandable, and the way she wrote wasn't engaging and put people to sleep. Furthermore, in person, Johnson was rude and antagonistic, and she alienated the people whose help she needed. The bottom line was that no law enforcement organization had been persuaded by her and her incomprehensible blog. But Curtis didn't care. Curtis wanted her stopped. So Bill and Marjorie had tried to stop her. They started off with a low-key approach. They had a lawyer send a cease and desist letter to Johnson, warning that she would be sued for libel if she continued to make blatantly false accusations against certain people named in her blog. Letters from lawyers terrify most normal people. Normal people can envision spending massive amounts of money and time battling a lawsuit and then ultimately losing the lawsuit and everything they own to pay off the lawyers and penalties imposed by the court. But Sarah Johnson wasn't normal, and the letter from the lawyer didn't deter her one tiny bit. She posted the letter verbatim in her blog, citing it as an example of the kind of thing Curtis would do to stop any investigation into his criminal activities. Next, Leonard Curtis did sue her for libel, and Johnson's lawyers responded with a motion for discovery, asking for virtually every document Curtis's businesses had generated in the last 2 years. Curtis's lawyers were now fighting Johnson's lawyers to keep her from getting the documents. Curtis also had courts in 3 states issue restraining orders against Johnson, specifying she couldn't call him or come within 100 yards of him. These orders were granted, and frankly reasonable, because for a while Johnson was essentially stalking Curtis. When Curtis's lawsuit didn't stop her, they tried to scare her by having a crude, rough-sounding guy make harassing phone calls, saying he was going to kill her if he lost his job because of the things she was doing. They figured Johnson had to know there were violent yokels all over Montana and the Dakotas, and they all owned guns. In other words, they thought she'd take the threats seriously. And maybe she did, but she didn't stop going after Curtis. Then Marjorie had an idea she was sure would work. Using Curtis's money, she convinced an editor at a major East Coast newspaper to offer Johnson a job investigating coal mining in West Virginia and Kentucky, places where they literally blew the tops off mountains to get at seams of coal. Marjorie figured that working for a legitimate newspaper on a big-time environmental issue would appeal to Johnson's ego as well as her crusading nature. But that didn't work either, because by this point Johnson's primary focus wasn't the environment. Her mission was to nail Leonard Curtis. Marjorie and Bill's next move was to have Gordy completely fuck up Johnson's website, figuring she wouldn't have the resources to fight off a cyber attack. They also had 3 more people file lawsuits against her, thinking that she wouldn't have the money to fight 4 lawsuits simultaneously. And that's when they found out that the 22-year-old college dropout was extraordinarily rich, thanks to her dead mother. Sarah's lawyers were now doing everything they could to turn the lawsuits into jury trials, where Leonard Curtis would be subpoenaed to testify. The last thing they did was send 3 guys to rough her up. This had been Bill's idea. Marjorie said at the time she thought it was a mistake, but Bill said that a young woman, all on her own, might be brave when it came to lawsuits and harassing phone calls, but real physical violence was a whole different story. So Bill told the guy he hired not to hurt her, but to do his best to scare the living shit out of her. But as Marjorie had predicted, all the assault did was piss Johnson off, and the cops were now looking for the people who had assaulted her.
"So, what are you going to do next?"
Curtis asked, as they sat there drinking ice-cold coffee. "Mr. Curtis," Marjorie said, "I know you don't want to hear this, but I really think we ought to just leave that crazy girl alone. Nobody's listening to her. Nobody takes her seriously. Nobody reads her stupid blog."
"I read her damn blog," Curtis said, smacking one of his small fists on the table. "I want her stopped."
"Okay," Bill said, seeing that Marjorie was getting nowhere and just making Curtis angry. "We'll regroup. We'll come up with something."
"Yeah, well, if you don't, I'll find somebody who can," Curtis said.
That was the very last thing Bill and Marjorie wanted to hear. They knew Curtis was happy with their work, but they also knew he wouldn't hesitate to fire them. Curtis fired people the way cats shed fur, and they knew they'd never find jobs that paid anywhere near what Curtis was paying them. Chapter 7. Curtis left the Perot Grill at 9:30 to go back to the Radisson. Curtis was a man who went to bed every night at 10 p.m., and he allowed nothing to keep him up any later. As soon as he left, Marjorie and Bill ordered drinks, a Glenlivet neat for Bill, a glass of good Merlot for Marjorie. They never drank when they were with Curtis because Curtis didn't drink. "What are you going to do?" Bill said. "I don't know," Marjorie said. They sat for a couple of minutes, sipping their drinks, saying nothing, as they tried to come up with an idea to stop Johnson that might actually work. Finally, Marjorie said, "There's always Murdoch." "Ah, Jesus, Marjorie. Murdoch, are you serious?" "Yeah, I guess I am. I don't want to do that, but Johnson's irrational. She's insane. She's been butting her head against a brick wall for 2 years, yet she refuses to stop. She's too rich to buy off, and she's too crazy to scare off. I mean, she's like those fucking Muslim suicide bombers. She's willing to blow herself up, to blow you up. How can you deal with a person like that?" "But Murdoch," Bill said. "Hey, if you got a better idea, spit it out." When three men in ski masks terrorized Sarah Johnson in a dark parking lot, the short ringleader had been Bill's ex-brother-in-law. His name was Tim Sloan, and Bill could understand why his sister had divorced him. Tim was a lazy, shiftless, useless slug whose primary source of income, after Bill's sister divorced him, was a Social Security disability check for a non-existent back problem. But Tim wasn't totally stupid, and he was always desperate for money, as long as he didn't have to work too hard for it, so Bill used him occasionally. Bill and Marjorie's territory covered three large states, and Tim would be sent to pick up documents that they didn't want emailed, as emails left a traceable record. A couple of times, Bill had Tim volunteer to help out on the campaigns of candidates Curtis opposed, hoping Tim might overhear something that would give Curtis's guy an advantage. One time they had Tim deliver photos to a certain judge when they wanted to impress upon him the inadvisability of a ruling he'd been about to make. And Tim was the gravelly-voiced man who had harassed Johnson with nasty phone calls, threatening to kill her if he lost a job that he didn't have. But Murdoch was in a completely different league than Tim Sloan. The first and only time Bill and Marjorie had used Murdoch was 6 years ago. It was so long ago, they could almost convince themselves they'd never used him at all. A lawsuit Curtis couldn't afford to lose had made it all the way to the South Dakota Supreme Court, and if the court ruled against him, it was going to cost him millions. To make matters worse, this occurred during the Great Recession of 2008, and even Curtis was having financial problems. The problem was that there were five justices on the South Dakota Supreme Court, and Bill and Marjorie knew that two were going to rule against Curtis, two were going to rule in his favor, but they had no idea what the fifth justice was going to do. The swing judge was an unpredictable screwball named James Wainwright III, who had no consistent record on anything. It was as if he flipped a coin every time he made a decision. To make matters worse, Bill and Marjorie hadn't been able to find anything they could use to persuade Wainwright. He was rich, and as best as they'd been able to tell after having a private detective watch him for 2 months, had no vices they could use to control him. If Wainwright was gone, however, the governor would appoint his replacement. Curtis had no strong hold over the South Dakota governor, but the governor was gas-friendly, and Bill and Marjorie were about 90% sure he would pick a guy who would rule in Curtis's favor. So they just had to get Wainwright off the bench. They had to. And after everything else they'd tried had failed, Curtis told them to call Murdoch. They had no idea how Curtis knew Murdoch, and Curtis, being Curtis, wouldn't tell them. It was apparent, however, that he'd used the man before. Bill met with Murdoch in a steam room at a small gym in Denver, clad in nothing but a white towel, a practical precaution to ensure Bill wasn't wearing a wire. Murdoch turned out to be an average-looking guy of indeterminate age. He could have been 45 or a decade older. He had receding dark hair, brown eyes, a bony nose, and thin lips. He was in good shape, but he wasn't physically impressive. He wasn't any more muscular than Bill. Nor did he look the way Bill imagined a contract killer would look, evil, steely-eyed, cold as ice. If Murdoch had said that he sold vacuum cleaners at Sears, Bill would have believed him. Bill told Murdoch that Judge Wainwright of South Dakota needed to have a fatal accident within the next 3 months, but the judge couldn't be obviously murdered. Murder could lead to all sorts of problems, and the last thing Curtis wanted was some hotshot law enforcement team investigating Wainwright's death. 6 weeks later, Wainwright drowned. He owned a cabin in the Black Hills and liked to fish for trout in the small streams near his place. His body was found lying in less than a foot of water in Spearfish Creek. It appeared as if he'd slipped, hit his head on a rock, fell into the water unconscious, and drowned. He was still holding his fishing rod in his hand when he was found. The rock that he'd smacked his head on was lying near him, his blood on it, and there was no evidence that anyone else had been with the judge, such as fingerprints on the rock or footprints that didn't belong to the judge or tire tracks from a second vehicle parked near the scene. At least, no evidence that a local county sheriff could find. But Bill didn't want to bring in Murdoch to deal with Sarah Johnson. He'd lost 10 pounds and didn't sleep soundly for 3 months after Wainwright's accident. God damn it, there has to be another way, he said to Marjorie. Bill, Marjorie said, I don't want to do this either, but I've got 2 boys to send to college one day, and my house isn't going to be paid off for another 15 years. I am not going to let that girl destroy my life. Before Bill could respond, Marjorie's phone beeped the signal for a text message. It's Heckler, she told Bill. Let me see what he wants. Marjorie left the bar to call Heckler, and the reason she did was because she needed a cigarette. She never smoked around her kids, but she'd sneak one every once in a while when she was under stress. Heckler was a local private detective who they were paying to watch Sarah Johnson. He'd been following her for the last 3 months, although he couldn't stick with her 24 hours a day, as he needed to sleep sometime. Heckler also recorded her cell phone calls and used the GPS feature in Johnson's phone to keep tabs on her location. When it came to technology, Heckler was a dinosaur, but Gordy, Bill and Marjorie's grass-smoking associate, had downloaded the necessary spyware onto Johnson's phone. Marjorie had actually been amazed to learn that there were companies that legally sold software that could be used to monitor cell phone calls and track people's movements. According to these companies' websites, you had to have physical access to the phone you wanted to monitor and, of course, the owner's permission. But Gordy was smart enough to load the spyware onto Johnson's phone by embedding the software in an email he sent to her. Marjorie had told Bill she was thinking about having Gordy put the software on her kids' phones so she'd always know where they were and what sort of mischief they might be planning. Thinking about getting Murdoch involved, Bill decided to have another scotch. He looked around for the waitress and didn't see her, so he walked up to the bar. He ordered a drink from the bartender, then glanced down the bar. Aw, shit. There was a woman sitting there, glaring at him. He'd slept with her once, couldn't remember her name, and he had never called her back after the one time. He was trying to make up his mind if he should go say hello or just ignore her when Marjorie came back into the bar. She walked over to him and said, Come on, we don't have time for you to get laid. They sat back down at the table, and Marjorie said, Johnson met with a guy tonight. You mean she had a date? No. Heckler said the guy was older than her. Heckler said he was a hard-looking SOB. Those were his words. He said Johnson and the guy had a drink together, and she left an hour later. Heckler said it didn't look like a social thing. So who is he? His name's Joe DeMarco. Heckler got his name when he called Johnson. Then Heckler followed him back to his motel and paid a clerk to get a peek at the registration form. Marjorie paused before she said, DeMarco's from Washington, Bill. I mean, D.C., not the state. D.C.? Yeah. We better find out who he is before you talk to Murdoch. Bill didn't bother to say that he hadn't yet agreed to talk to Murdoch. All he said was, I think you're right. I just hope he isn't carrying a badge. Curtis will go through the roof if he is. Chapter 8 DeMarco stopped at a liquor store after his meeting with Sarah, bought a bottle of Grey Goose, and went back to his room at the Holiday Inn Express. The ice machine on his floor wasn't working, and he had to go up 2 floors before he found one that was. He dropped ice into a plastic glass, added 2 ounces of vodka, and plopped onto the bed with his laptop. For the next hour, he read Sarah Johnson's blog. He stopped when it felt like his brain cells were turning to mush and starting to dissolve. The girl may have been smart, but she couldn't tell a story. She wrote in convoluted sentences that went on forever, and sometimes a single paragraph would fill an entire page. She was repetitive, making the same argument over and over again in case the reader didn't understand it the first time, and her stories were filled with trivial details that she apparently thought were necessary to prove she'd done her research or to validate whatever she was saying. She used capital letters to emphasize her points, and every other sentence had some phrase or word capitalized, and as if that wasn't enough, sometimes double exclamation points served for periods. But the gist of the blog was basically what she'd told him in Minerva's. Leonard Curtis and the many companies he owned had incredible luck when it came to state laws and rulings handed down in various courtrooms. However, there was nothing even close to proof that Curtis had done anything illegal. In one case, Sarah concluded a state legislator in Montana, who was also a wheat farmer, had changed his vote based solely on the fact that the man got a good deal on a farm implement called a seed drill. DeMarco had no idea what a seed drill was, but the story about the legislator and the seed drill illustrated the depth Sarah went to in order to get information and, at the same time, how tentative her conclusions could be. In this case, Sarah learned a Democrat named Reynolds had strayed from the party line and changed his vote on a bill proposing to increase taxes on natural gas to aid school funding. She went to see Reynolds and asked him why, and he refused to talk to her. So Sarah started talking to other Democrats who had a stake in the bill to see if they could explain Reynolds's treachery. One of the legislators, a man named Franklin, who was also a farmer, was quoted in Sarah's blog saying, "I actually wonder if it had anything to do with that seed drill he got at Colson's for $10,000. I mean, I've never heard of a guy getting a deal like that, and he was bragging about it, so it wasn't like he was trying to keep it secret, but it was right after that he started arguing against the bill." When Sarah asked Franklin if he was saying that he thought Reynolds had been bribed, Franklin started backpedaling, saying he wasn't about to accuse a fellow Democrat of doing anything illegal. It took Sarah a week to learn that Colson's was a farm that had gone into foreclosure, and that Curtis had bought the land and then hired a broker to sell off the farm equipment. One of the items being sold was a practically new white 8186 seed drill that would normally sell for about $25,000. Based solely on this information, the fact that Reynolds changed his vote on a bill Curtis didn't want passed and was given an extraordinary deal on a piece of equipment that Curtis owned, she concluded the seed drill was a bribe. The problem, DeMarco immediately realized, as would any other lawyer, was that no one could prove that Reynolds had done anything illegal. Reynolds would argue that he was just a shrewd negotiator, and Curtis's broker didn't understand the value of the item he was selling, but whatever the case, the price he got for the used seed drill had nothing to do with his vote. In another section of her rambling blog, Sarah listed by name every politician and law enforcement person she'd contacted in an attempt to get these individuals to investigate Curtis. She called them obtuse, lazy, and blatantly corrupt. The girl did not know how to make friends and influence people. And DeMarco had another image of Sarah as Joan of Arc, on a big white stallion, dressed in chain mail, wielding a broadsword, whacking the heads off English horsemen. And a few French horsemen, too, if they got in her way. Which reminded him, he needed to tell Sarah not to mention him or Mahoney in her blog. He'd tell her, if she did, that he'd walk, and she'd be on her own again. The last thing DeMarco needed was to have his presence in Bismarck advertised, and Mahoney would go ballistic if his name appeared in her blog without his permission. The problem was, DeMarco wasn't sure he could control Sarah. He wasn't sure anyone could. Tall, pretty, blonde Sarah reminded him, in some ways, of dark, dour Ralph Nader. Nader was old now, around 80, but he came to national prominence at the young age of 31 when he wrote Unsafe at Any Speed. Like Sarah, Nader was passionate, fearless, insensitive, and didn't care whose feet he stepped on. But in spite of a tendency toward bluntness that bordered on rudeness, DeMarco liked the girl. When he was her age, he was still in college and spent more time chasing co-eds and drinking than he did studying, while here was Sarah, trying to make the world a better place. However, he had no idea how to help her, nor did he have any idea how to keep her from getting killed if somebody really wanted to kill her. And after spending only 1 hour with Sarah Johnson, he knew she wasn't going to give up until either she was dead or Curtis was in jail. Then one thought finally occurred to him. He grabbed his cell phone and called Sarah. Marjorie got up the next morning at 5:30, as she usually did, took a quick shower and blow-dried her hair. She stepped on the scale in the bathroom, made a face, then went and got dressed. As the coffee was brewing, she looked at the calendar on the refrigerator door. Bobby had a baseball game tonight. She'd try to make that. Tommy was going over to Henry Grove's house to play video games after school. Marjorie didn't trust Henry Grove. He He was a sneaky little shit, and she was convinced that he was a bad influence on Tommy. The last time Tommy had been to Henry's house, Marjorie thought she got a whiff of pot off Tommy's hair. But it was hard to be sure. The odor mixed in with sweat and all the other pungent teenage boy smells. She mentioned this to Henry's mom, suggesting she might want to poke around in her son's room and see if she could find a bag of dope. Naturally, Henry's mother had been offended, and things were still a bit cool between her and Marjorie. Marjorie left a note for Dick, giving him his marching orders for the day. Drop off the dry cleaning, take the 3 boxes of crap that have been sitting in the garage for a month to Goodwill, call a plumber like she'd told him 2 days ago to come fix the leaky faucet in the master bath, pick up the boys after school, drop off Tommy at Henry's house, then take Bobby to the baseball field, where she'd meet him. She'd pick up Tommy from Henry's place after the game so she could sniff his hair again. She signed the note, Love and Kisses, M, grabbed her purse, her keys, and headed out the door. She didn't look at her cell phone until she got to work. Her plan that morning was to get on the phone and start calling people in Washington to figure out who this guy DeMarco was. When she pulled out her phone, she saw a text message from Heckler. He'd sent it at 11 last night. It said, call me first thing in the morning. It's a big deal. She called Heckler.
Jesus, what time is it?
He said. 6:30, Marjorie said. Your message said to call you first thing in the morning.
I didn't mean 6:30.
Wake up, Heckler, and tell me what's going on.
Hang on. I want to play you a call Johnson got last night from that guy DeMarco.
She heard Heckler getting out of bed, coughing, a cigarette lighter clicking, and then he said,
okay, I'm going to play it back. Sarah, it's Joe DeMarco. I've been reading your blog, and I wanted to ask you something.
So now do you see what I mean about the shit that Curtis has been pulling?
Yeah. Anyway, what I wanted to ask is this. Who paid these people you think were bribed?
What do you mean? Curtis paid them.
I kind of doubt that Curtis paid them directly. I mean, I can't imagine him personally arranging for some legislator to get a good deal on a seed drill, whatever the hell that is.
Well, of course he didn't do it personally. Curtis probably has 20,000 people who work for him, with all the companies he owns. He retains a law firm that employs over 80 lawyers. Those are the people who are making the payoffs.
I don't think so, Sarah. I think Curtis is a guy like me.
A guy like you? What do you mean?
I mean, he's probably got a guy he uses for this sort of thing. A guy who fixes things for him. He wouldn't have 2 dozen people buying off politicians and judges. He'd want somebody he could trust. Somebody he knew was competent. Probably somebody who's worked for him for a long time.
And Marjorie thought, oh shit.
So Sarah, I wanted to know if you've ever come across somebody like that. A single person, an operator, who might have met with all these people you say have been bribed or blackmailed or whatever.
No.
What I'm saying is, if he can find that person, and if pressure can be brought to bear on him, maybe he can be forced to testify against Curtis, because he's the guy who's really committed a crime.
How would you pressure him?
I don't know. But the first thing we need to do is find him.
If he exists.
Yeah, if he exists. I'll talk to you tomorrow, Sarah.
And Marjorie again thought, oh shit.
That's it, Heckler said. But I thought you ought to hear that.
You thought right. Now get out of bed and get back on her.
Marjorie sat for a minute, then reached into her purse for the pack of Marlboros and went outside. Bill would give her a ration of shit if she smoked in the office. This was bad. Sarah Johnson had never mentioned Bill or Marjorie in her stupid blog. They had no documented connection to Curtis, at least none that Johnson would be able to find. Their consulting firm wasn't owned by Curtis. It wasn't one of Curtis's many companies. And Curtis was not identified in any public forum as being their client. But if Johnson talked to the right people, it was possible, although highly unlikely, that some of those people might say that she and Bill had approached them on Curtis's behalf. 99% of them wouldn't talk, of course, because then they'd be admitting that they'd been bribed or influenced in some way. But maybe one of them would. Maybe one of them was no longer in politics and had grown a conscience. Maybe one of them felt that he or she had been screwed by Curtis in some way. All Marjorie knew for sure was that DeMarco had pointed Johnson in their direction. And that wasn't good. She needed to find out who this damn guy was. Bill rolled into the office about 10. He wasn't his normal, cheerful self. He looked grim. He'd probably been thinking about the fact that he might have to go to Denver to see Murdoch again. "We have a problem," Marjorie said as soon as he walked through the door. "I thought we might have. I saw the cigarette butts out by the door." Marjorie told Bill about the conversation Heckler had recorded between DeMarco and Sarah Johnson. Bill's reaction was, "Oh, shit." "Who is this fucking guy?" Bill said. "I've been on the phone for the last 3 hours trying to figure that out. He's a lawyer, and he works for the House of Representatives, but it's not clear what he does. He's not listed as being on anyone's staff. And get this, his father was an honest-to-God mafia hitman up in New York."
"Mafia? You think DeMarco's mafia?"
"No, shut up. I said his father was mafia. He's not mafia. At least, it doesn't sound like it. Anyway, I finally got to Peach." Jeremiah Peach was an aide to Congressman Sam Earhart, Montana's sole representative in the House. It seemed as if Peach had been in D.C. since the British burned down the White House, and whenever Montana elected a new representative, Democrat or Republican, the new congressman kept Peach on his staff, because the new guys the new congressman brought with him didn't really know how things worked on the Hill. Peach told me that DeMarco is a shady character who works down in the sub-basement of the Capitol. He's a lawyer, but as far as Peach knows, he doesn't practice law. When I Googled DeMarco, I found out he made the news about a year ago. You remember Bob Fairchild, that congressman from Arizona who paid an ex-cop to kill a woman in Tucson?
Yeah.
Well, DeMarco was the one who caught the killer, but none of the articles made it clear as to why he was involved at all. But the main thing Peach told me is that DeMarco might work for John Mahoney.
Mahoney? You mean the guy who used to be the speaker?
Yeah. Peach said DeMarco's not on Mahoney's staff, but it seems like whenever Mahoney has some sticky problem to solve, DeMarco shows up. Peach said it's like DeMarco's this dog Mahoney keeps in a cage, and he only lets him out when he wants someone bit. Peach also said that since John Mahoney is as corrupt as any African dictator, this means that DeMarco isn't some Boy Scout lawyer who plays by the rules. Why the hell would John Mahoney care about Sarah Johnson? Bill said. I have no idea. But this is bad, Bill. The last thing we need is someone with a connection to Mahoney. Johnson can't get anybody in law enforcement to give her the time of day, but Mahoney can probably get the FBI involved with one phone call.
What do you want to do?
I'm still thinking Murdoch may be our best option. In fact, I think he's our only option.
You want Murdoch to...
Bill wasn't even going to say the word kill out loud.
You want him to take care of both Johnson and DeMarco?
Hell no. If Johnson has an accident, that's one thing. If something happens to both her and DeMarco, I don't even want to go down that path.
But if something happens to her, even if it's ruled an accident, then DeMarco might keep digging anyway.
Yeah, I know.
Should we tell Curtis about DeMarco?
Not yet. He'd go apeshit if he knew a guy working for Mahoney was out here talking to Johnson. We need to come up with an answer before we talk to Curtis.
Chapter 9. DeMarco called Sarah and suggested they meet for breakfast.
I don't usually eat breakfast, she said.
Well, I do. And pick a place that makes a real breakfast, not some coffee shop or a McDonald's.
He met her at a Denny's on 7th Street and ordered French toast, sausage links, and eggs over easy. She had a coffee.
Like I told you last night, DeMarco said, Curtis probably has somebody working for him that's his go-to guy for payoffs. I mean, if you're right about Curtis.
What do you mean, if I'm right? She said, her eyes bugging out of her head. I thought you read my blog.
I read enough to know that you don't have any evidence that Curtis did anything illegal. On top of that, your blog's so damn convoluted and wordy. Nobody can read it without going into a coma. Your granddad said you have money. Maybe you could hire a writer to turn your research into a book or a magazine article.
Then he immediately wished he hadn't said that. He could tell he'd hurt her feelings.
I mean, you have a lot of data and a lot of good arguments,
DeMarco said, trying to sound soothing. I'm just saying a pro could make it more accessible. But that's not what I wanted to talk to you about. Can you think of anyone who's taken a bribe that might be feeling some remorse, some guilt? Or maybe somebody who's now pissed at Curtis for whatever reason? I've been thinking about that ever since you called last night. I need to go back through parts of my blog again and look at my raw notes.
Okay, do that. In the meantime, I think you should hire some security, a couple big guys licensed to carry.
Yeah, maybe.
Sarah, people have threatened to kill you twice. You've been assaulted. You need to take the threats seriously.
Yeah, I know,
she said. But DeMarco could tell she wasn't going to do anything. Like most 22-year-olds, she thought she was immortal and invincible.
How did you get into all this stuff with Curtis in the first place? He asked.
It started out when I got interested in fracking and all the damage that it was doing to the environment. I went to a couple of rallies, met some activists, and joined up with a group in Billings for a while. Then one night, my group went to a public hearing in Bismarck, and... You remember what I told you last night about Stevens?
The farmer with the easement?
Yeah. We figured that Stevens was going to speak out in favor of the bill to increase inspections on blowout preventers, but instead, he talked about how the existing requirements were good enough. But you could tell he didn't really believe what he was saying. I mean, the guy just looked ashamed. And one of the people I was with said it was obvious that Curtis had gotten to Stevens, bribed him or blackmailed him or something, but that we'd never be able to prove it. But I decided to see if I could. I knew if Curtis had given Stevens cash or transferred money to an offshore account, I wouldn't be able to find it. But in Stevens's case, it was easy because everything was a matter of public record. What I mean is, Stevens filed a lawsuit against the farmer, who withdrew the easement, and later Stevens dropped the lawsuit, so it was easy to connect the dots.
DeMarco almost said, well, you found some dots, but I'm not sure you really connected anything, but decided to keep his mouth shut.
The next thing that happened, Sarah said, was a circuit court judge named Hardy ruled in favor of something that benefited Curtis in a big way. You don't need to know all the details, and since you don't know anything about how they process natural gas, you wouldn't understand anyway, but this judge's ruling didn't make sense. It was just absurd. Well, I found out that Hardy was running for re-election that year, and about 80% of his campaign contributions were coming from Curtis and guys who worked for Curtis and companies Curtis owns.
DeMarco shrugged.
Yeah, well, you know.
What the hell does that mean? That, yeah, well, you know.
DeMarco always told people that the United States of America has the best government that money can buy. And he was serious. And that's what he told Sarah.
Sarah, that's politics in this country. People and companies contribute to guys who see things their way. It's not a conspiracy. It's not illegal. It's just the way things are.
That doesn't make it right.
I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that Curtis didn't do anything illegal by supporting this judge for re-election.
It looked for a minute like Sarah was going to erupt, like Vesuvius. Then she took a breath.
Anyway, you asked how I got started. That was the beginning. After that, I just started digging into anything that favored Curtis. Bills in the legislature, court cases, lawsuits. I filed FOIA requests. I looked at key people to see if they benefited in some way. I looked at property records to see if they bought a second home and at building permits to see if they were remodeling their houses. I talked to their neighbors and their political opponents. She took a breath and said, I'm a hell of a researcher, Mr. DeMarco. I may not be a writer, but I work hard, and I know how to dig to find things out.
And DeMarco believed that Sarah Johnson was a hell of a researcher. But she didn't seem to be able to grasp the fact that just because a politician benefited at the same time Curtis benefited, that wasn't prima facie evidence of bribery. Rather than argue with her, he said,
Okay, so go back over your blog and your notes and think about who might give us a lead on the person Curtis is using to fix things around here.
I will, she said and stood up. But then what? What do I do when I've got some names?
Then we go lean on these people and try to convince them to talk to you. I'm not much of a researcher, but I'm pretty good at leaning on folks.
You'll go with me? Seriously?
Yeah, for a while. I mean, I have a job in D.C. I need to get back to, but I'll give this a few more days.
Sarah marched out of the restaurant like a woman on a mission from God. Actually, the only job DeMarco had back in Washington was doing whatever Mahoney told him to do, and for the present, Mahoney wanted him right where he was. DeMarco just wanted to get back home to see if Ralph had annihilated the rodents. DeMarco finished his breakfast, then decided to call Ralph and ask how things were progressing.
"Things are going good," Ralph said cheerfully. He was a cheerful killer. "They already ate 2 boxes of the decon, so when I drop by your place tomorrow, I should find some bodies inside the house."
"You mean outside the house?" DeMarco said.
Yeah, that's what I mean," Ralph said.
As he walked to his car, DeMarco thought about calling Mahoney to let him know what was going on. But then he couldn't help but notice that it was a lovely spring morning. There had to be a public golf course somewhere in Bismarck. He'd go rent some clubs and play around, then call Mahoney. Nothing was going to change in 4 or 5 hours, except maybe the weather, which might preclude playing golf. He wished he'd brought his golf shoes with him.
"Maybe we're overthinking this thing," Marjorie said to Bill. She'd just come back into the office after another cigarette. Bill couldn't recall her ever smoking this much before. She must have gone through a pack since she'd arrived at the office.
"If something happens to Johnson," Marjorie said, "it'll end with her.
Like we've tried to tell Curtis a million times, she doesn't have any proof that we or Curtis or anybody else has done anything illegal. She's just got a lot of conjecture and coincidence."
"Conjecture that's dead spot on," Bill said.
"But it's conjecture, Bill. It isn't proof.
If she's gone, this DeMarco character will go home. He doesn't have contacts here. He doesn't know how things work out here. But the main thing is, he can't be as screwy as Sarah Johnson. He won't spend the rest of his life investigating all the crap she's written about."
"I'm still not sure we should use Murdoch. There has to be some other, you know. I think it would be best if it looked like a home invasion, or robbery, or a rape."
"What?"
"I mean, if she's just shot or something," Marjorie said.
"The cops might think she was killed for some reason connected to all her political bullshit, and they might think that Curtis was involved. So, you see what I mean? We shouldn't make it look like she was, you know, assassinated."
Bill was speechless. You look at Marjorie. Cute, bubbly, bouncy little Marjorie, and you think, soccer mom of the year. You'd never imagine that a woman who looked like her could be so cold-blooded. But there'd been plenty of times in the years they'd worked together when Bill had seen how she reacted to anyone trying to stop her from doing what she wanted, and although she didn't resort to murder, she could be downright brutal. Sometimes she just scared the shit out of him.
"You know, if DeMarco comes up with our names," Bill said, "we could end up being suspects."
"Which means we need to move fast, before he gets our names. You need to contact Murdoch today."
"Why don't you contact him? I contacted him last time."
"And then what, Bill? I'm supposed to sit in a steam room naked with Murdoch?"
"Maybe he has some other procedure for when he meets with female clients."
"Quit being childish. You're the one he knows. And what about my kids? I can't just go taking off for Denver."
"Yeah, well...
Hey, we're in this together, no matter who talks to him."
"Not exactly. I'm the guy Murdoch will give up if he's caught."
"And then you'd give me up," Marjorie said. "And don't tell me you wouldn't. We're in this together."
Bill didn't normally drink at 11 in the morning, but today was different. After Marjorie nagged him for half an hour, God, the woman could nag, he felt sorry for her husband. He finally agreed to call Murdoch, and that's what he was going to do. But he needed a drink first. He didn't want to call Murdoch. At the same time, he didn't want to lose everything he had. He liked his life the way it was, and he knew Curtis would fire him and Marjorie if they didn't solve the Johnson problem. Or maybe, knowing Marjorie, she'd blame their failure all on him, and only he'd get fired. And no one was going to pay him what Curtis paid him. He didn't want to lose his job. When Murdoch had taken care of Wainwright, the swing judge in South Dakota 6 years ago, that hadn't really weighed on Bill's conscience all that much. He'd been scared, of course. He'd been scared for 3 months. that he might be arrested as an accomplice to murder and end up in prison for the rest of his life, but he hadn't really felt all that guilty. For one thing, the judge had been a disagreeable old fart. But Johnson, she was different. She was a young woman, practically a girl. He knocked back a shot of wild turkey, then ordered another. Finally, he called Murdoch from a payphone in the bar. Murdoch didn't answer the call, and no way in hell was Bill going to leave a message. He called again 1 hour and two more shots later. Murdoch still didn't answer. Bill finally decided he needed to leave a message and stopped at a Best Buy and bought a prepaid phone using cash and giving a phony name. He called Murdoch a third time, and when Murdoch still didn't answer, he left a message. "We met before, 6 years ago. You did some work for me. Please call me at 701-220-1048. It's urgent, and I'll, compensate you accordingly." While he was eating some lunch to soak up the booze, Murdoch called him. "This is the guy you called," Murdoch said. "Thanks for calling back. I needed a..." "Stop. I don't do business over the phone. You remember where we met last time?" "Yeah. Meet me there again." Bill tried to figure out how long it would take him to get to Denver. "I'll be there sometime late tonight," he said. "Make it tomorrow morning. 10 a.m., Murdoch said. "And bring the down payment with you." Before Bill could tell him again that the matter was urgent, Murdoch hung up. DeMarco was on the eighth hole at a golf course called Hawktree, 5 miles north of Bismarck. Hawktree was an unexpected jewel, like an oasis in the desert. Lush, emerald green fairways and black sand bunkers surrounded by rugged rolling hills covered with rust-colored, long-stemmed native grasses. He'd never played on a course in the middle of a prairie, and he could imagine a million buffalo traveling over the fairways before they became fairways. He'd just landed about 50 yards from the pin after making one of the best 6-iron shots he'd ever made. It was a shame there'd been no one with him to see it. He was just coming forward with his pitching iron when his cell phone went off like a burglar alarm and the ball went skittering off the end of his club and landed smack dab in the middle of a sand trap. "Fuck!" he cried. He took the phone out of his pocket. As he might have guessed, it was Sarah Johnson, a woman perfectly suited to screwing up what he was sure would have been a perfect shot. "Yeah, Sarah, what can I do for you?" "I've got 4 names. They're located in..." "Just tell me when I get there. I can be at your place in a couple hours. Your grandfather gave me the address."
2 hours? She shrieked. "Where are you? What are you doing?"
"I'm just busy. I'll see you in 2 hours. He hung up before she could tell him to make it sooner. It seemed only reasonable that he should take the shot over from where he was standing. It wasn't fair he should have to hack his way out of a sand trap because of a badly timed phone call. Chapter 10. "She just called DeMarco," Heckler said.
"Yeah," Marjorie said. "She said, I got 4 names.
"So what were the names?"
"No, you don't understand. All she said was, I got 4 names. And before she could say who they were, DeMarco said he'd meet her at her place and hung up. So I don't know who she was talking about. I'm just telling you, she sounded excited and said, well, I already told you what she said.
You stay glued to that girl like, you stay glued to her."
"I will."
She called Bill to tell him that taking care of Johnson was even more urgent than she'd originally thought, but the call went to voicemail. She wondered if Bill was already on the plane to Denver. He'd better be on the plane. He'd better not be ignoring her phone calls. But 4 names. What 4 names? Who was that crazy bitch talking about? What did these people know? DeMarco pulled up in front of Sarah's place. He saw that she lived in a duplex, an old 2-story white clapboard house with a big front porch and 2 brick chimneys, and not an apartment complex as he'd expected. He knocked on the left-hand door, the one with the letter B following the address, and she answered a moment later.